Hello and welcome to the Lifetime Athlete Podcast. This is episode number 121, and today's title is Updates on Dietary and Training Experiments. I'm your host, John Zombro, physical therapist, peak performance coach, and author, and I'm here with marketing expert and co-host, PK.
Don't you get me off on a bad foot. I'd rather just everyday person, everyday humanoid. It's fine, John.
My bro, my coach, my bro coach, my brooch, and not only a marketing expert, a communications expert.
Oh my God, stop saying the M word. It's horrible. It sounds terrible. I'm upset now. We'll just say man on the street, pulled off the street, and that'll be fine.
And so many times when we do this format of the show, it's our main format, we'll come up with some things that are important bits of science and nutrition and training and have a discussion. And I know you like to take that role of, say, being, kind of like the consumer and put sure, me in sure. the role of the disseminator. But I think it's fair to flip back and forth as human beasts that we are. And so here at the Lifetime Athlete, one of the things that we are always talking about is, science meets common sense. And so we want to really look at what the evidence-based items are that we have in these lifestyle practices that we're performing. What are good, solid first principles that we can work from? But also, what do your instincts say? What does your inner wisdom tell you? And test things on yourself. And so that's where we were going into with today's show, is because as I encourage all of my clients and this audience to experiment, I also do it on myself. And so I've got,
First of all, you do it. I mean, you're patient zero for self-experimentation.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to walk the talk, of course. Sure. And so I've been messing around with a few items, over the winter last quarter, in the dietary and training world, and today is probably going to be kind of a lighter side thing where we just talk about, what happened? What do I think? What do I know? Which oftentimes is not that much. And so here we go.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe even, the way that I think about it is, what'd you learn when you took a hypothesis and you tested it out on yourself and you sort of narrowed it down enough to get the variables organized in a way where you could basically make sense of this and that. You had a control group on some level. So where are we going to start? I'm all ready.
Yeah. I would say before I jump into that first topic, you just keyed something up for me, which is how learning takes place, or, how we start to figure out, oh gosh, this is really how I make my unique body or being perform better, feel best, all of that. And it's a very nonlinear experience. We do these tests and we hear about what might have been shown to be valuable in the laboratory, or what someone else has said, man, this really works well for me. And then we apply and say, oh, okay, well, now I got humbled here, or, oh, I got inspired, or the light bulb went off. And then I finally found the way to tweak something. So it's like, I've got something I can carry through this life journey and help me to be, peak performing athlete, but also just as good of a person that I can be.
Absolutely. Well, and John, I like when I encounter anyone who does this because it gives me a chance to learn. I like to do the same kind of things. Off and on in my life. So I like to learn. I love to learn from you because you really do approach it like a scientist, and you always have some really good discipline to get down to discover some things.
This is going to be an organic conversation, and organic sometimes fits into diet when we talk about certain things. And so
that's a professional transition there.
The metabolic flexibility diet. So quick backstory on the MetFlex plan. That was from last month. There were a couple of articles that came out on the Lifetime Athlete. And also, you and I discussed this concept of metabolic flexibility. And so I thought I would share what I did over the month of March and what I think happened.
Let's hear it.
So with Netflix, the idea there is that the healthy, high-performing, well-adapted athlete has the ability to essentially burn both fats or carbs for fuel and in different contexts of diet that has merit. And so the main idea with the Netflix plan was not to pair the fats and carbs together in a relatively high protein athletic diet, but to eat the fats with protein in the AM and then eat the carbs with protein in the PM and not really combine fats and carbs together in the same meal. So an example would be, I might have had eggs with something else in the morning, and that could have been avocado or cheese or bacon or sausage, because that would be very high fat, lower carb. And then in the evening, maybe that was chicken or fish or lean red meat with then ample amounts of vegetables and then a small amount of starchy things like potatoes or rice. And that was what I did for the most part for the month of March. And I had a number of other people as well. I'm still collecting some data from them on it. But the whole idea was to get these bennies of staying metabolically fat adapted, to be able to, burn fat and have all that benefit and stable glucose levels, but also to effectively restock the glycogen stores in the muscles every evening to then support high-intensity athletic endeavors.
Interesting. Okay. I'm tracking. So how did it shake out?
Well, ironically, I felt no improvement in, power output, and I really didn't see any measurable improvement in my work capacity or the KPIs or key performance indicators that I was using over the past 4 to 5 weeks.
And so when you're talking about the kind of carbs that you were working in with the protein in the evening, you're talking about good, clean carbs, right? Like what kind of nutrition were you consuming?
Yeah. Basically, most of my carb sources were coming from fruits and vegetables, varying types, and then eating those in the PM hours of the day with the system that we set up. And if anybody wants to go back and kind of refer through it, it's very sure. Detailed. But here's the thing. I wanted to stay open-minded. Isn't that one of our objectives here? We always want to be open-minded and recognize that we're going to have biases, but also try to minimize those. And so I was trying to give carbs a chance, give them more of a chance, because we still have in both the gen pop and also the athletic population a very carb-centric mindset where it's like you've got to eat. If you're going to be athletic, you've got to pound carbs, because that's the only way that you're going to restock this muscle glycogen and be able to have high glycolytic power output. And N equals one says no.
Right. So you sort of went on an exploration to take something that you were skeptical about, give it kind of going with a neutral, open state of mind. And you found that you did not have better performance in those activities that would typically have been supported by a more carb-centric nutritional consumption.
I did find that fairly definitively, but here's where my open mind hopefully comes in, is it's still actually possible that I didn't train hard enough or long enough to really get into that need to potentially, it's theorized, not necessarily proven, need to really eat several hundred grams of carbohydrate, every evening to be able to come back and train again the next day. The best current science is very supportive of the concept that long-term, and long-term would be a key word that many of the, let's say, fatally flawed studies don't utilize. The long-term fat-adapted person restores muscle glycogen on a low-carb diet just as fast or even faster in one particular study, actually called the FASTER study, it was an acronym, ironically, than the carb-dependent athlete. So to be clear, there still may be this case where if you're working out for several hours per day, fairly hard, back to back, you know, there might be, there's going to be a more discernible benefit to carb consumption. But if you're kind of like, you know, Joe average like me, and you know, you're training, say at best over the month of March, 60 to 90 minutes a day, and only a small fraction of that was high intensity, I didn't create a need for carbohydrates to maintain technically my best performance.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by the long-term fat adapted? What's long-term refer to?
Well, I've been eating a fairly low carb diet now for, I want to say going on 6 years.
Sure.
And again, what the research supports is that, you know, people who go 12 to 18 months, on a low carb diet, they actually get most of these, you know, enzymatic and metabolic upregulations, where they're very efficient at using stored body fat or ingested fat and protein for fuel, and also creating, you know, we don't need to eat glucose. We make glucose. We can make it from fats, protein, or carbohydrates. But the studies support that the body just, I mean, it's a brilliant, you know, ancestral design. So, okay, if I need to put, I need to make some glucose, or need to store some, you know, storage form of it, which is glycogen in the muscles and liver, I can do it. And so that's kind of what the research supports. Although, again, in the sports world, carbs are adored and they're defended. There's a lot of, you know, marketing involved. but I guess my point would be, maybe they're not questioned enough or tested enough.
Sure. They're also desired. Let's add that into adored and defended. I mean, there's, they're also, people want to eat them for different reasons other than performance. So that's also worked into that mixture. I'm interested in, you know, I know you're going to continue experimenting, but what were some of the, I'm sure you have a list of takeaways that you had from this experiment. What were they?
Well, I gained 4 pounds last month.
You diesel, you did not, really?
Well, it wasn't all that. I mean, if you apply, you know how like in photography, they have the rule of thirds as far as like, you know, you've got your foreground, your subject, sure, your background, you sure hear about that. Well, you know, there's also kind of a rule of thirds that, you know, multiple people have put out with regards to bulking or massing or gaining. I know Mike Israetel's group at Renaissance Periodization likes to refer to this as well, that basically in the presence of, let's say, a caloric surplus and plenty of protein and strength training, you're going to gain weight. But what you're going to gain is about, you know, 33% muscle, 33% fat, and then also some water retention because of the metabolic factors there. And so I put on 4 pounds pretty rapidly, you know, over a month. And what I learned from that is that if you're trying to gain weight, carbs really help you. I mean, if you want to make gains, you know, get just gains in gains in body mass, not all of it's lean, sure, body mass, sure. You know, put carbs in your diet, and the research supports this, that you will be more easily able to gain weight. And I would go back and say one thing about, sometimes we get very muscle centric as well, you know, carb centric, muscle centric athletes. But lean body mass also includes bone, and it includes organs. And so sometimes I'll have a client who, man, their clothes are fitting great, they're feeling great, you know, and they've lost like 1 pound over multiple months. But I'll say, well, yeah, but you know, let's do a few measures that we can do, because the data really suggests that you've gained some muscle mass, you've lost some body fat, your bones are now denser and stronger, and so are your organs beefed up a bit. So again, just, you know, putting all that into context.
Oh man, it's funny thinking about, you know, like strength training your organs. It's just a silly thought. All right, carry on. What else did you learn?
The beast is the beast is the beast, right? And so, you know, that isolationist view of thinking, it's, I mean, we're taught to do that, you know, but really the body is the body, the being is the being. And so, yeah, you can't really grow muscle without growing bone and a bigger liver and kidneys. But anyway, back to this. Part of it was that those very low fat dinners that I had been eating, you know, so if you eat like a plain chicken breast, maybe it's got some seasoning on it, but you know, not like, it doesn't have olive oil and that kind of thing. And maybe you have some vegetables, but there's no butter on it, you know. that kept me hungry. It takes longer to get satiety because, you know, protein contributes to satiety the strongest, but fat is the slowest to digest. And so that combo of fat protein together, like meat or eggs or anything, you know, that you see those things together, that's what really satisfies appetite, makes a person stop eating. And so I actually, you know, one of the reasons why I gained that weight was I was eating easily, you know, on average, just tracking that through chronometer, you know, an extra 400 or so calories every night just to feel like I'd get full, you know. So it'd be like I'd have several servings of those vegetables and maybe some fruit. And it was finally like, okay, now I can stop eating because I can make it through the night. And so, again, you know, maybe over more time I could have adapted, but the extra carbs were making me hungrier and I just was eating more food and more calories. So that's where some of my weight gain probably came from.
Well, absolutely. I think that, you know, I mean, that makes sense. It's just so interesting. Again, N of one, Jay-Z of one, but even still there's lessons to be gleaned in there.
Yeah. And, you know, you'd mentioned before, you kind of alluded to it that, you know, carbohydrates are addictive, especially the processed kind. And, you know, since I spent much of my life enjoying those, you know, that that history put me on a slippery slope. And I would say, sure. You know, for me, you know, once I started, you know, like letting some of that get back into my diet, it's really easy to let more in. And so I really had to watch it with, you know, eating white rice, which is a really popular, you know, athlete food, you know, as kind of like a quote unquote clean carb. I had to make myself to cook very little of it because I would just eat whatever I made. And so if I made a pot of it, it was really hard for me to not just, just pound it.
You've mentioned before, you love white rice. I think that speaks to my earlier point that, you know, it could have a place in the carb replacement world for athletic reasons, but then there's also that sort of creature comfort and just like palate.
Oh yeah. And based on my genetics and maybe my metabolism that might have been damaged earlier in life and is never going to be perfect again. White rice is like candy, you know, I mean, and what I mean by that is, you know, it converts to sugar very, very rapidly in the bloodstream. It's high glycemic for most people, but me in particular. So I can eat like a sweet potato, which I don't like as much as the white rice. And, you know, I don't get the huge postprandial blood sugar spike, but if I eat the white rice, I mean, it makes me pretty much pre-diabetic. And so it's like, man, lesson learned. Your mileage may vary, you know, you, PK, and audience, but, you know, for John Boy, just keeping carbs a little bit on the lower side and, you know, maybe just really watching out for not eating very much of the ones that I've identified to be triggers over the years.
Sure. But super honest and, you know, honest with yourself, I mean, and you're just testing this stuff out. It came from an open-minded place and you came out on the other side again from a very sort of neutral, just considering it like data, despite what your desires are. What else did we do last month?
Oh man, actually, I started in way back in December of 2019, if anyone can remember that far back. I started with this, let's call this experiment, the poor man's sauna. And I kind of had talked about it, I think, on the show a couple of times. Well, finally, you know, I got the experiment finished and the data collected, and I'll also have a video out this week to explain that more descriptively. But what I wanted to do was take a full 3 months and compare a couple of things. So first of all, if we just talk about sauna in general, and maybe you should say sauna, you know, whatever. We know that the research is very strong that regular sauna use decreases cardiovascular risk. It improves aerobic fitness. It is correlated positively with longevity. And there also are these detoxification benefits where, you know, it helps people to rid themselves of accumulations of toxins like heavy metals. So all those things are not debated. They're known, you know, to varying degrees. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to compare using a traditional sauna, sometimes called traditional Finnish sauna, mm-hmm. whether it's wood fired or not, really hot, dry, with the infrared sauna, which I have a little phone booth, you know, here at home, which I can utilize for that purpose. And then also with the, bringing it back to the 70s, the old style vinyl suit that you could work out in. And I happened to pick one up a few years ago at a party. Even on the box, it says sauna suit, the classic.
What kind of side note, what kind of party were you? Don't answer that. That'll be a follow-up episode.
I can say it was a white elephant Christmas party. And that thing kept going around. Nobody wanted it, but I was like, I got to have it. So that I guess it. Okay. Idea got hatched a long time ago. So anyway, what I did, finally to make it clear, you know, I had limited access to the traditional sauna. So that's one of the reasons why it took me so long. I have a friend who's a carpenter who has a really nice wood-fired sauna. And then also, you know, a couple of the places around our community, you know, have some commercial ones that's where I was doing the traditional sauna work. And at about 215 degrees, couldn't take it for a straight 30 minutes. So would do about 10 minutes, you know, step out for a brief cool down, go back in and repeat that for three cycles. So I'd get 30 minutes of exposure. With the infrared, it would run at about 135 degrees. So the heat's not really the factor. It's the infrared rays that are working on you. 30 minutes continuous in there. And then with the sauna suit, I put on pretty much like a double sweatsuit underneath the sauna suit with a hood and a hat. And in a 70 degree room, I just did kind of a light circuit workout for 30 minutes. And the circuit was deceptively challenging, actually, because 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off. So I'd do 30 seconds of body weight squats, rest for 30 seconds, 30 seconds of push-ups, rest for 30 seconds, and then 30 seconds of jumping jacks. And so 10 cycles of that, essentially, to get through. And wow, that was a good workout. You get a real good glow on from that. And also, I should mention that I was measuring some things. Not only, you know, hoping to get those health benefits and some subjective things, but I wanted to look at what the body weight change pre-post was. And so that was via sweat loss. And so I would just get on the scales before and after. And since it was only 30 minutes, I didn't drink during, but I would rehydrate heavily afterwards with plenty of salted water. So I was looking at body weight. I was looking at heart rate immediately post. And so as soon as I got out of the saunas or finished the workout, I would just check my pulse rate and see where it was. And also body temperature using a thermometer. So those were the things that I measured. And the results were interesting to me. And I'll, like I say, I've got them charted out for the video, but I can say a few things.
Well, please do. If you can't, then we're in trouble here. Yeah. So lay it on me.
Yeah. When have I ever not been able to say a few things? So there have been occasions stymied, but nothing beats that heat and the feeling of the traditional sauna, hands down. I've got to say that, man, you know, wow. I mean, it's the real deal. And, you know, someday I want to have one. It's a big investment, but it's just so powerful and amazing. You know, you get in there and, you know, you bake, and then when you're finished, you know, you have this, just that feeling. It's fantastic. So I'm going to say that first of all, that the feeling of the traditional sauna won hands down.
Okay.
But surprisingly, the double sweatsuit workout, or I guess it was kind of triple with the vinyl over it, it caused more sweat loss. So, you know, total weight loss difference was greater in the workout than it was in either sauna condition. Almost got the body temperature as high as was achieved in the traditional Finnish dry sauna, running at 215 degrees. You know, body temp went up. I think my average was like 2.2 degrees in there. And it was just a little less than that with the workout. And also the workout, which is no surprise, highest in heart rate, you know, mm-hmm. post-exercise heart rate was a little higher than it was coming out of any of the saunas.
Interesting. Okay. So, I thought you were going to keep going there. So what'd you learn? What's ultimately, if you said, okay, we're comparing all this, what'd you learn?
Well, I would say I am convinced, as are many people, that saunas are awesome and good for us. And if we can get that benefit on some level of frequency, you know, a couple times a week seems to be well supported in the literature. And that was kind of my experience. You know, I mean, subjectively, you know, I think you tend to feel really good. And maybe there's a great benefit to that on multiple levels of life and health and fitness. But really what we're trying to do there is heat the body up, sweat a bit, release these heat shock proteins, you know, all that's, again, becoming fairly well known. So my recommendation is for anybody to get a sauna effect any way that you can. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so the drum roll, you know, please, would be that the infrared sauna is fine. You know, it's they're inexpensive and they have unique benefits. One of the things is you get a fairly good heating and sweating of the body without the perceived heat stress that you get either from the workout mm-hmm. or the hot sauna. I mean, when you're in the hot sauna or you're getting to the end of that workout, I mean, you're really looking forward to, you know, the end or getting out. Whereas in the infrared sauna, you just don't feel that as much, you know? Mm-hmm. But I guess my point was, in my N of one, the sweaty workout is pretty doggone good. And, you know, based on how I felt and also the measures that I took, it might be a great home COVID sesh for people to shake things up a little bit right now. It's like, hey, look, you know, you're doing some home workouts. You know, you could use my little Mickey Mouse 30-minute circuit, whatever you want to do. You don't even have to have the vinyl suit, because if you put on two sweatsuits in a warm room, or if you have like a nylon, you know, shell type stuff on the outside, you're going to do a little more laundry, of course, we accept that. But yeah, you can get your glow on, and I think it's valuable. So that's what I would recommend, is like, hey, no matter how you do it, there's a way. And back to the original topic I had, poor man's sauna, I'm all for it. I don't think you're losing much.
Interesting. So basically, you just get in where you fit in here. If you can, any sort of sauna is good. But if not, just doing the sweaty workout, you got most, if not all, the benefits in a different way.
Sure seems to be the case. And that's exciting.
It sure is. Well, I think what it really means is that it's accessible. And, you know, I think that almost anyone has a half hour and a couple sweatsuits out there, maybe a vinyl jacket to give that a shot. Interesting. I guess I wouldn't have thought that. I would have thought that since those are three distinctly different environments, that there would have been some variability, but I guess just get the heat and get the bennies.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. It's also very empowering info. You know, and that really leads me to this next point. I have always, even as a kid, I've just enjoyed messing around with heat and cold. You know, it's okay. That's one of my characteristics, and I don't know what's the driver there. But I've also, over the last year, I've really been exploring the use of cold mm-hmm. for effects other than suppressing inflammation.
And when you say other than suppressing inflammation, it's because, I mean, you only phrase it like that or frame it like that because the cold has been shown to improve inflammation.
Yeah. And particularly, I mean, obviously when we have these acute injuries, you know, you might put an ice pack on. That's one example, but the main one is the use of these cold tanks. And so, you know, for years and years in the training rooms, you know, there'd be like the stainless steel tank and the ice cubes, and the players would get in, you know, try to stay for oftentimes 4 minutes. And, you know, this was a protocol. And then more recently, you know, we've gotten, enlightened about all the health benefits mm-hmm. potentially that happen if you do regular cold exposure and do it long enough to you know, really get the chill and really drive a lot of those changes in the body. Well, okay, that's a known thing, and the data has become fairly clear that if you want to maximize your adaptations to training, mm-hmm. you wouldn't do those cold soaks because it curbs your inflammatory process so strongly, doing it long enough again, that you inhibit some of the adaptations that happen from training. Mm. But if in the case of the athlete that needs to compete or train hard, again, close together, back-to-back days, you know, you just got to come back as quickly as you can, even if you have a few percentage points less gains, then that's where, you know, doing it in like that full body prolonged manner is going to be most valuable. But here's where I look at it differently. Okay, that's either to do it or not to do it, whether mm-hmm. you're talking about, you know, speeding up recovery versus making gains. But if you don't stay in very long, and obviously this depends on the temperature, you mainly get this your metabolic upregulation and excitatory effect. So, you know, a quick dunk can, you know, just kind of rev up your sympathetic nervous system, get you, you know, kind of, you know, and
what again, do you mean by quick? Let's say you were talking about a cold tank, like you're saying, like with some ice water in there.
And well, I mean, that's why I said, you know, it time and temperature.
Of course it varies, but let's just say, I mean, what do you mean by a short?
Yeah. So if you're dealing with like 34 to 36 degree water, I mean, you might be in there for 30 seconds. If you're dealing with, you know, 55 degree water, it could be, you know, 5 minutes or something. So that's short enough. Yeah. Because you're not truly driving core temperature down and shivering with those exposures. That's the point to make, you know, we just want to have that quick dunk. Well, what that does is it excites the sympathetic nervous system, and, you know, upregulates fat burning, some other things. And so if you use it ironically as a pre-training or pre-event exposure to get up, I mean, it's kind of funny that you use cold for warm up, but in a way, yes, you know, you can do that. And so if you have, you know, like you're going to go out on your mountain bike and maybe you've got this section on the trail that's like from tree to tree or rock to tree, and you're like, every time I go by, I blast that thing. Well, if you took a quick cold dunk, maybe in the stream or something out there, keeping it natural, got redressed. And then, you know, once you got going again, you'd probably break your personal record having done that.
So you can use it kind of as a primer again, for based on the temperature for a quick dunk or a quick soak. Interesting. Okay. So it can rev you up.
Yeah, and I like you use good words there, like prime, rev, cue, activate, potentiate. Those are better words than warm up, because that just sounds too discordant. But yeah, you can use cold for that. And I've been kind of messing around with that. I think, I've done it enough to say that, yeah, that really can help you. And you can do the same thing with a cold rinse in the shower when you finish off. You know, if you really want to be sharp for a meeting or something like that and have that extra spring in your step, maybe not during the coronavirus pandemic, going to the office, but going to your remote work center. Yes. So enough said on that. And then I would say, if you just want to, again, now this I have to explain this to make it not controversial. Let's say you do a hard workout, long workout, hot workout, that really, you know, that feeling, you know, the body is drained, but it's staying activated. It's still kind of amped and ramped. And, you know, you're tired from the workout and you want to get back to your baseline, back to that parasympathetic nervous system, rest and digest. Now you can use, I'll say cold, but cool might be better, to just, again, you know, briefly for a couple minutes, take a cool rinse, take a cool soak. After that heavy duty workout, it'll bring your temperature back down and help with bringing the heart rate back down, so that now you get back to the parasympathetic state when adaptations happen. So we, you know, during this, when you're doing things, that's sympathetic. That's really a breakdown state. You know, we make the gains when we get back to, you know, the chill zone. And so again, if you don't do it too long, you're not going to suppress your adaptation. You're just going to get back into the adaptive zone more rapidly.
Interesting. So let's say we're doing this in the shower. And so we have that cold water coming out of the ground. What do you think the temperature would be on that?
You know, it depends on where you live, first of all, and whether you have a well or municipal water. But, you know, most places, except for the heat of the summer, in some places, you know, that water temperature does go up. But because it's underground, you know, you're really looking at in the 50s. You know, and like water coming out of my well, you know, it's 300 feet deep. So most of the year it's like 51 degrees. So it's pretty cold.
Okay. Yeah. So let's say in the 50s, let's say mid 50s. And, mm-hmm. and what do you mean by just kind of a brief cool soak or cool shower in this case? What would be brief?
Yeah. A shower, you could probably go a little bit longer than you would with a full body immersion, particularly with a head dunk, again, mm-hmm. according to the research. But mm-hmm. I would say, you know, 2 minutes in the water, maybe underwater tank, and then three in the shower, just sure, enough, sure. you know, so you don't feel, it's not overly stressful. It's more calming because it's pulling you back to midline.
Mm-hmm. I'm not buckling you down. We know all the different variables. I'm just saying, like, if you hadn't done it, you might think that 15 seconds is brief. And you're really saying, got to give it a couple minutes, even in something like mid 50s in the shower.
And coming back to that, it depends, might be the best answer there. I would say, yeah, in general, a couple minutes is really what we're talking about. But sure. If you're very sensitive or you don't need much, okay, sure. maybe that 20 seconds is going to be adequate.
Well, maybe, I mean, obviously it depends. Experiment. You're an N of one. If you're the listener, so are you, Jay-Z, so am I. But I just, you know, I wanted to just, I guess, ferret out some more of the nugs from you, my friend. I want to mine those nugs and share them with the peeps.
Well, and that's why this episode, as many of them are, you know, brought to you by the Lifetime Athlete Coaching Services. So if these cutting edge ideas, yet basic nugs, appeal to you, you know, maybe consider doing some coaching to help you to, you know, achieve peak performances, improve your body comp and health.
Absolutely. Get that knowledge. It's right there.
LifetimeAthlete.com/coaching.
I love it. Are we going to, any other experiments from Mars that you're going to drop some knowledge on us?
My most recent love affair with an exercise.
Oh boy. Don't stop.
It had been over a decade, for no reason, since I had performed a landmine press.
Okay, a landmine press. What is that?
Okay, so done most appropriately, a landmine press is a station with a sleeve on it that you can slide the end of an Olympic barbell into, and then you only have plates on the far end where you are located, so you're lifting the bar, the plates are close to you, and it's pivoting up and down at an angle. So that's, you know, you'll sometimes, you know, Mickey Mouse way to do that in the gym would be to slide a, you know, a barbell into a corner, although it does tend to cause damage, and so that's not the best way to do it. And so the stations, landmine press stations, you can buy them, you know, made of steel anywhere, and they'll vary in price from $30 or $40 to several hundred, depending on what the exact application is.
Sure. Okay. Got it. Basically, you're just a pivot that holds the opposite end of the barbell in place.
Yeah. And so I had a bunch of scrap materials around the garage, so I just built my own. And
of course you did. Yes.
Yeah. Because I wanted to just get into the exercise, for some reason, I just awoke, you know, after a decade of not doing that movement, like, oh, you know what? I need to do some landmine presses. And so that's kind of the true story. An Olympic bar is best. It kind of works best for, you know, both those sleeves and also, you know, just how you can load the weight and et cetera. But you can also use the smaller setups, the 1-inch bars with the basic weights. And again, as long as you make sure that it's rigged up solid and safe, that's the key. I wouldn't advocate trying to do this exercise with the bar, you know, sitting freely anywhere. I think that's asking for something negative to happen.
Got it. Okay. So what kind of lifts are you doing?
Well, there's a couple variations of the landmine press, but my favorite two, would be a bilateral, that just means using two hands, angular press from a diagonal stance deep squat. And so you can picture this, I'm holding the bar, I'm a little bit quartered to it, and I'm down, you know, pretty much in a full squat, but you know, not a real long warrior lunge pose, but you know, kind of compressed like that, and then kind of extending upward through the legs, the trunk, and then finishing with the arms. Love that move. I love the fact that it's triplanar and it works on kind of, you know, using some rotary function in the body, which is, you know, life's not linear, right? Or all sagittal plane. So I love that move. Doing both directions, of course. And then the other one that I like quite a bit, you have, for me, I have to use quite a bit lighter weight, is unilateral. You're just using one arm, facing squared up, but from a half kneeling position. And so now I'm down on padding. Half kneeling means, you know, you got one knee down, the other foot's forward. And just a great way to work on going through the body and fully, you know, going from elongated to compressed status. And huge trunk or core strength when you do that.
So just to clarify, you're going from half kneeling to standing with your arm extended over your head, back down.
Oh, then, now that's another variation.
You're just extending your arm up?
Yeah, so I'm just
doing. Got it.
Yeah, I'm just doing the press from the
kneeling. Oh, the press. Got it.
Okay. Whereas if, you know, like you said, if I was locked out, kind of like a unilateral overhead squat or overhead, you know, lunge, that split squat, that would be, you can do that too. Maybe you've inspired me.
It's almost like a landmine get up or something like that, a half get up.
Yeah. And the cool part about all of this is that, you know, the vector changes as you're straightening up or rising up, and it becomes slightly less vertical, slightly more horizontal. So that's functional for quite a bit of sports, but also it is very kind in terms of loads on the skeleton and the joints, but also very challenging for the muscular demand.
Yeah. And, you know, now that you're describing it, it's also functional for life. Like when you have to do, like, let's say you're building a teepee or something like that. Like how you do it is you press it up, you angle up the long thing, or, you know, that's how you lift a board and interesting. Oh, well, are you going to make a video on that, you think?
Yeah, I think I'll try to get one out on the YouTube channel soon. And of course, another thought, you know, that I've had is, you know, once we get into summer, I'll be out doing my firewood cutting, and I'll probably cut a few timbers, lodgepole pine or Douglas fir, that are 8-10 feet in length. And if the diameter's not too big, it obviously wouldn't be too big. I might just crank out some landmine presses out in the field before I block those babies up.
You savage. Oh my. I mean, now you're showing off. Really?
I'm not sure I'm capable of showing off. I could try, but
that embarrassed giggle that you have, you know, you are capable of showing off, you solid gun.
I would just give you an opportunity for great laughter. How about that?
Absolutely. I'll take it every time.
Oh, cool. Well, so, I mean, those were the experiments I've been involved
Sweet.
In.
You know,
just going back, say, hey, folks, explore this idea of metabolic flexibility. See what happens for you. It's a healthy diet, so you're not going to go wrong there. Look at the concept of the poor man's sauna, aka the sweatsuit workout. Fool around with cold and see how, you know, it can help you to get up as well as down and for the things you're doing. And then also safely explore the landmine press exercise if you can rig something up safely, again, because it's wonderful.
I love it. I tell you what, I'm going to be experimenting with that myself.
Yeah, just in closing, I'd say if you're finding the show useful, enjoyable, or if you've been listening for a while, but you haven't yet left us a review, oh, please do.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're with us, we're almost 45 minutes in right now and you haven't left a review, I tell you what, it sounds like you're a 5-star kind of a guy or gal, and we'd appreciate it.
I'm feeling the love. So coming up, just a few cool things that are going to be happening.
Cool.
I want to show that landmine press. I've got that kind of as a plan on a video. There's a sandbag workout, you know, so I'm a big advocate of using the sandbags. And
I'm a sandbagger.
Yeah, and I've had a few people recently ask me, hey, you know what, I'm going to put together some kind of a sandbag right now for working out at home. You know, can you show me a few exercises and maybe a workout sequence that would be easy to do? Yes, that's going to be up. We're going to look at some foot-based topics. And I really, these are ones that have always been kind of I'm passionate about. They're in my area of specialization. I want to revisit the annual revisit, essentially foot function and pronation, share some new research, and also, you know, help people to get a better understanding of how critical it is to know what's happening at your foot and then also maximize it for your health and performance. And then lastly, it won't be too long. We're going to do a strategic view on the demon. Let me say it again, the demon known as plantar fasciitis.
Oh, I tell you, people, it is going to be a takedown. It's going to be WWE from the top ropes, expose, page six, National Enquirer. I'm telling you, it's going to be all those things and more. The demon is going down.
Well, we're a team, we're a tribe. So what we'll all be doing is roundhouse kicking to the face at mediocrity, self-doubt,
for
adversity.
For me, to the ankle.
Yeah. Oh, I'll stop. But hey, listen, stay to UPK and everybody else. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay peak performing, be hard to kill, and always, of course, always be a lifetime athlete.